himself, who had recruited a high-powered group to lead programming for the park's event spaces. Critics also questioned how public funds for parks were being allocated. In New York's poorer neighborhoods, hundreds of parks had fallen into disrepair and badly needed upgrades. Yet, Diller had succeeded in orchestrating a project that would draw millions of government dollars for a park in one of Manhattan's wealthiest areas, a neighborhood that already had two major parks, the Hudson River Park and the High Line. What sort of way was that to make decisions about public spaces? Welcome to the era of super citizens, where philanthropists are literally reshaping the geography of our cities. Barry Diller's projects have been small in comparison to what billionaires are backing elsewhere. In Houston, the energy pipeline magnate Richard Kinder and his wife Nancy are tapping a multi-billion dollar fortune to remake parts of that city. They're helping finance a transformative 150-mile system of urban trails called the Bayou Greenways, one of the largest parks projects in the United States. The Kinders' money has also gone to other parks projects throughout the city. Like Diller and Furstenberg, the couple signed on to the Giving Pledge early on. It was not a tough decision, since they had decided years earlier to give away 95% of their wealth. Much of that giving is focused on Houston, the city that Rich Kinder credits with enabling him to make his fortune, with its open, entrepreneurial culture. "In Houston, you are what you achieve," the couple wrote in their Giving Pledge letter. Beyond new parks, the Kinder Foundation is pouring millions into the city's schools, hospitals, and social service organizations. Not far away, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the billionaire George Kaiser is spending even more lavishly. Like Kinder, Kaiser believes that parks are a key to vibrant cities and is underwriting a vast riverfront park in Tulsa that may be even costlier than the Bayou Greenways. Kaiser is giving $350 million for the project, dubbed a gathering place for Tulsa, the largest sum ever committed by a private philanthropist to a public park. Kaiser is so rich that he didn't need to bother with getting government to pick up part of the tab. His foundation is not only paying to build the park, it will pay to maintain it. George Kaiser's money is reaching into other parts of Tulsa, too. A liberal in a deep red state, he has pumped millions into building state-of-the-art early education centers that serve low-income children, and given even more to help set up health clinics in schools and public housing projects. In his Giving Pledge letter, Kaiser wrote that America had failed to live up to the ideal at the core of its social contract, equal opportunity. Kaiser's solution is to use his own funds to help those left behind by the accident of birth. He wrote, "If the democratically directed public sector is shirking, to some degree, its responsibility to level the playing field, more of that role must shift to the private sector." Kaiser knows that he can't remake all of U.S. society, no matter how many billions he has. So he's focused narrowly on the goal, as his foundation puts it, of making Tulsa the best city for children to be born, grow, and succeed. In San Francisco, two wealthy funders, the Haas family and the billionaire Stephen J. Bechtel, were instrumental in transforming part of the Presidio, a former military base near the Golden Gate Bridge, into a national park. Bechtel gave $35 million to the effort. Meanwhile, the tech billionaire Mark Benioff has, along with his wife Lynn, led an ambitious push to improve Bay Area hospitals, giving $200 million for new facilities in San Francisco and Oakland. Benioff has also worked to rally tech companies behind local anti-poverty efforts, rounding up donations from firms widely criticized for boosting inequality to new heights in the region. His company, Salesforce, has made improving local schools a top philanthropic priority, giving millions in grants and organizing its employees to volunteer their time tutoring kids in subjects like math and science. In Boston, the Barr Foundation, created by cable TV billionaire Amos Hostetter Jr., and his wife Barbara, has emerged as one of the most influential institutions in the city, public or private. It has given hundreds of millions of dollars in grants, with this money flowing to nonprofits working in every corner of city life. Former bar staffers have become top officials in city government. Among other things, Barr has been a leading player in helping orchestrate an arts renaissance in Boston, arguably wielding as much power in the city's cultural sector as any public agency. The Hostetter Foundation is also deeply involved in K-12 education and transit issues. The couple, who live in a historic mansion on Beacon Hill, keep a low profile in Boston, but they are widely seen as among the most powerful people in the city. In Chicago, money given by the Pritzker family is shaping many areas of city life, to the point that one of those heirs, J.B. Pritzker, has been called the other mayor of Chicago. In Cleveland, the Gund family has poured millions into civic projects aimed at revitalizing a famously battered industrial city. It put funds into revitalizing the city's public square, as well as assorted other projects, including parks. Not far away, in Detroit, a coalition of the top foundations in America pooled over $800 million to save the city from bankruptcy. One foundation involved in Detroit, Kresge, is even helping underwrite a new light rail system downtown. Shaping how we live. Power comes in many forms in public life, but one of its most tangible manifestations is the ability to shape the communities in which millions of people live. And now, more than at any time in memory, philanthropists are exercising such power, not just by financing parks, but by underwriting the physical expansion of top universities and hospitals, as well as major cultural institutions. A few miles north of Diller Island, gifts by two billionaire donors to Columbia University Business School, totaling $225 million, are helping fuel a transformation of West Harlem that has pushed out some longtime residents and businesses. One housing advocate called the sprawling new campus Columbia is building a quintessential, if extreme, example of how difficult it is for communities to be heard when powerful institutional neighbors propose development or redevelopment. That's all the more true when such neighbors are backed by billionaire donors. Across town, on Roosevelt Island, some $600 million in gifts from three philanthropists is helping create a science campus for Cornell University. Of course, remaking urban public school districts has also been a top project of the new philanthropists. In New York, the Fund for Public Schools has raised more than $350 million since 2002. Smaller efforts of donors, in the Big Apple and elsewhere, have included pushing for bike lanes and building public libraries and gardens and swimming pools. Some of the most ambitious projects of private donors are done in partnership with government, with the result that philanthropists have become more deeply enmeshed in the machinery of civic life. Much of this philanthropy gets celebrated without many second thoughts. Parks, libraries, and museums make cities livable. Top universities and medical research centers make them great, attracting talent from around the world. What's not to like? Maybe a bunch of things, as the case of Diller Island suggests, from who is making choices over public life to who actually benefits from those choices. What's happening in cities like New York and Houston is a microcosm of a broader power shift whereby private donors, who are both more numerous and more wealthy, are stepping into a vacuum created by the decline of the public sector. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio may not be able to find much money for big new projects, but Barry Diller can. Here, too, though, the story isn't a simple one. Yes, it's troubling to see such public power in the hands of private individuals. On the other hand, donors like Diller and Kaiser are bringing badly needed new resources to boosting America's cities at a time when more people are embracing urban life. Their projects often bypass the grueling process of waiting for funds to be appropriated, assuming money can be found at all, and then waiting for the gears of public agencies to slowly grind forward. The givers can get things done, and fast. What's more, while private donors like Diller appear alarmingly unaccountable, public officials haven't always been so accountable themselves. Robert Moses, who famously transformed the New York area with highways, bridges, and parks, did so in part by amassing unprecedented power as an appointed government official and using it in authoritarian ways. In fact, much of the urban renewal of the mid-20th century wasn't so pretty, as government reshaped cities through massive highway and housing projects. The Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956 was a powerful tool in this regard, giving state and federal government control over new highways, including the power to smash those roads through urban neighborhoods using eminent domain. Urban renewal projects, dreamed up by public officials, remade numerous cities in the 1950s and 1960s, at times in destructive ways, as vibrant communities were destroyed or relegated to the shadows of elevated highways. Philanthropy was sometimes involved in these big makeovers, although typically in a supporting role, with government agencies mainly driving the action. John D. Rockefeller III may have chaired the private fundraising effort that raised tens of millions of dollars to complete Lincoln Center, the performing arts center in New York City, but the project was Moses's idea. It was he who appointed Rockefeller to the job and invoked the power of eminent domain to seize 67 acres of land and demolish blocks of Upper West Side tenement buildings that housed some 3,000 families, most of them African American. In Pittsburgh, the philanthropist and real estate developer Richard King Mellon, an heir to the great Mellon industrial fortune, was instrumental in instigating the massive demolition and redevelopment projects that transformed downtown Pittsburgh in the 1950s. He also pushed for urban renewal as a supporter of the American Council to Improve Our Neighborhoods, which promoted redevelopment. But government funds were indispensable for the massive projects that Mellon envisioned. In many other cities, philanthropy played little or no role in a broad refashioning of urban life during the 1950s and 1960s. This was a golden age for men like Moses and Edmund Bacon, another top urban planner who served for decades as the leader of the Philadelphia City Planning Commission, remaking that city to the point that he is sometimes referred to as the father of modern Philadelphia. Elsewhere, it was mayors who had the grandest urban visions, such in Chicago, where Richard J. Daley orchestrated any number of major construction projects during his 21 years as mayor, including O'Hare International Airport and numerous expressways. Today, there are plenty of visionary public officials aiming to reshape cities, but they often have fewer resources to work with. Pension outlays have been swelling in many cities, crowding out other priorities. Federal assistance to urban areas, in decline for decades, fell even more sharply after Congress made sweeping budget cuts in 2011. Aid to localities from federal programs for job training, water safety, transportation, law enforcement, and more has dropped across the board. Funding for parks has been among those areas hit by recent budget cuts. Not that there was much federal aid of this kind left to pare down. A few decades ago, from the mid-1960s through 1981, Congress had appropriated an average of $626 million per year to the Land and Water Conservation Fund, LWCF, program in 2007 inflation-adjusted dollars, which helps finance the creation of parks, including urban ones. Between 1982 and 2007, however, the program averaged less than one-tenth that amount, or $61.9 million per year. In 2015, Congress moved to eliminate the LWCF program altogether. Among its powerful opponents in Washington, the Heritage Foundation, which published a strong policy brief that year calling for its permanent elimination. The memo's author was Nicholas Loris, a young policy wonk who was the Herbert and Joyce Morgan Fellow at Heritage's Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies. Herbert Morgan, the philanthropist who endowed Loris's fellowship, made his fortune in real estate law in the South. Heritage describes him and his wife as longtime proponents of free enterprise and limited government. Thomas Rowe, who funded the institute where Loris worked, had gotten rich by parlaying the company he inherited from his father into a Fortune 500 conglomerate. Before Loris came to the Heritage Foundation, he worked for the Charles Koch Charitable Foundation. There are a lot of people like Loris in Washington these days. Through relentless attacks on government over the past four decades, conservatives have pursued the dream of returning to a time before the New Deal and World War II, when the public sector played a much smaller role in American life. Among other things, they have argued that private charity did a much better job of fighting poverty in the 19th century than big government did in the 20th century. And they've suggested that public goods like museums and libraries are best financed by the private funds. Many libertarians go further, suggesting that schools and parks should also be funded privately. The right has come nowhere near to achieving its vision, but it's made some real progress, squeezing government funding for things like the arts, parks, libraries, and public universities. Elected officials of both parties, but particularly Democrats, have also helped weaken local government by not putting aside enough money to properly fund public pensions and entitlements for the elderly. Now the cost of these obligations is soaring. New York is a good example. City outlays for pension costs rose to around $8 billion in 2015, or 11% of the budget, up from 2% in 2000. Thanks to the Wall Street boom during some of this period, Mayor Michael Bloomberg still managed to increase public spending, including on parks, but in December 2013, Bloomberg warned that rising pension and health care costs threatened to doom urban government in coming decades. "It is one of the biggest threats facing cities," Bloomberg said in his final speech as mayor, "because it is forcing government into a fiscal straitjacket that severely limits its ability to provide an effective social safety net and to invest in the next generation, or to spend money on parks." These fiscal woes, whoever is to blame, have opened up more space for people like Barry Diller to make their mark on public life. Indeed, the strains on government have escalated at precisely the moment when a generation of aging billionaire titans like Diller, who started assembling their fortunes in the 1980s, are now looking to dispose of this wealth through philanthropy. That timing is fortuitous in some respects, with more private donors stepping up just as public agencies are finding themselves tapped out. But it's also alarming, raising questions about who is in charge of our cities. What's happening in Kalamazoo, Michigan, offers an unsettling glimpse of what the future of urban governance might look like. That former industrial city has long struggled with fiscal woes, and in 2016, Mayor Bobby Hopewell turned to a wealthy friend, William Johnston, for help in closing a growing budget gap. Johnston, who chairs a wealth management company, widened the conversation to include William Parfit, the retired CEO of a drug company and a local philanthropist. Eventually, the two men pledged $70 million over 3 years to help stabilize the city's budget, finance a reduction in property taxes, and bankroll new programs to reduce poverty and spur growth. The mayor and other officials hailed the gift as transformational and stunning in its generosity. It was indeed both of those things. Two wealthy patrons with deep ties to Kalamazoo were coming to its rescue at a moment of dire need. But, unmistakably, the gift also marked a shift in power away from the city's elected leaders toward private donors. Likewise, when a group of foundations orchestrated the even bigger bailout of Detroit, they secured a larger say over that city's future. The past offers some clues about what these new power arrangements may look like. Super citizens were familiar figures in the pre-New Deal era, before the rise of a stronger government, when private money loomed much larger in public life. Andrew Carnegie bankrolled libraries in cities around the country, among them New York. He gave millions to the New York Public Library, which had been created by Gilded Age philanthropists, to construct 65 branch libraries around the city. New York's earliest major cultural institutions were also the projects of 19th-century business titans, as was the case in many cities. Higher education, too, in America, was dominated by wealthy donors before public universities were invented. Private philanthropists also largely called the shots when it came to aiding the poor, which mostly fell to nonprofit charities. Settlement houses, one of the main anti-poverty tools of the time, were privately funded by wealthy donors and staffed by volunteers. Emergency food and financial support came from churches or civic associations. The United States is unlikely to return to this era of truly small government. Too many Americans believe in a strong public sector, and quite a few are pressing hard to expand government further. Still, there's little question that government will be doing less in coming decades, and we're already moving into new terrain in terms of who provides public goods. With government stepping back, philanthropy is stepping forward and occupying a bigger seat at the table of power than at any time in the past century. A Forgotten Borough. Not long before Barry Diller and Diane von Furstenberg made their giant gift to create a rarefied island park off Chelsea, Mayor Bill de Blasio had announced a new city effort to refurbish some 35 parks in overlooked city neighborhoods. This initiative only scratched at the problem of crumbling parks in poorer parts of the city. At least 200 parks around New York were in a decrepit state, and some of the city's poorest neighborhoods had no parks at all. De Blasio had vowed to promote parks equity as a candidate, and now he was trying to deliver as mayor. The total he'd managed to pull together to spruce up some 36 parks amounted to $130 million, the exact sum, coincidentally, that Diller and von Furstenberg pledged for their one 2.4-acre park in one of the city's most affluent neighborhoods. Before that gift, the biggest pledge ever to New York public parks had been John Paulson's gift of $100 million to the Central Park Conservancy, CPC, in 2012. The billionaire hedge funder lives less than half a block from the park in a 28,500-square-foot mansion on East 86th Street. And while Central Park had already become a shining jewel thanks to some $700 million in private donations since the 1980s, Paulson was moved to chip in even more. The Central Park Conservancy has flourished for obvious reasons. The city's premier park borders the wealthiest neighborhood in the city, the Upper East Side, and over the years, CPC had become a fundraising powerhouse. Its board of trustees includes numerous heavyweights from finance who live near the park, like Paulson, and its huge success is a classic example of how the wealthy give to organizations that directly enhance their lives. Yet, it would be wrong to settle on a reductive narrative of self-interest in explaining the new park's philanthropy being driven forward by super-citizen donors. For starters, Central Park is hardly just a playground for the rich. It also borders Harlem and draws people from all over the city and the world. Elsewhere, philanthropists have invested in parks with a close eye on equity concerns. The huge Bayou Greenways project in Houston that the Kinders are financing is designed to connect to nearly every neighborhood in the city, with the goal of getting people out of their private cars and backyards and into a public space that's accessible to all the people from the huge melting pot that is Houston. It's estimated that 6 in 10 Houstonians will live within a mile of the Greenways when the park is finished. George Kaiser's ambitious waterfront park in Tulsa is also designed to benefit everyone in the city. Meanwhile, in New York, not every wealthy philanthropist was sold on the idea of giving ever more money to Manhattan's parks. One major donor, Shelby White, set her sights instead on reviving public spaces in Brooklyn, a borough that the moneyed elite seldom visited, even as it began to gentrify. White is the widow of Leon Levy, a Wall Street investor who left the bulk of his fortune to a foundation when he died in 2003. She's a familiar type in the annals of philanthropy, the woman who outlives her wealthy husband and finds herself charged with disposing of his fortune once he's gone. A former journalist, White created the Leon Levy Foundation from scratch, building up a small staff and grant-making operation. And although she had long lived a Manhattan life of wealth and privilege, she had never forgotten where she came from, which was a Jewish immigrant household on Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn. When White found herself in control of a sizable foundation, one with assets of around $500 million, she decided she'd give back to the borough of her youth. "I was a Brooklyn girl and wanted to do stuff for my hometown," White told me. "To decide where to put money, I went to the places I had gone as a kid. First among them was Prospect Park, which, like Central Park, is a masterpiece designed by Frederick Law Olmsted. Prospect Park was my childhood park. I lived a block away. I did everything there. I went rowing. I went horseback riding. I had my first cigarette. I really loved Prospect Park." In the early 2000s, though, the park was sinking into neglect. The city wasn't putting up the funds to properly maintain it, even as park spending increased during the early years of Bloomberg's tenure, and it didn't have wealthy patrons. The Prospect Park Alliance lacked the juice of the Central Park Conservancy, with its Masters of the Universe board. "There were so many people doing stuff for Central Park," White recalled. "There was nobody doing stuff for Prospect Park." White decided to help right the scales, making a $10 million gift in 2008 for Prospect Park restoration work. It was the largest gift ever for the park, or any public institution in Brooklyn. With improvement in Prospect Park moving forward, White looked around at the other pillars of her childhood community. The Brooklyn Public Library, headquartered in a landmarked Art Deco building on Grand Army Plaza, was struggling. The Leon Levy Foundation gave it a $3 million grant designed to move the library into the 21st century with new information technology. The Brooklyn Botanic Garden, just a few blocks away, was also in poor shape, coping with crumbling infrastructure. White directed a $7 million grant toward building a new water system for the garden, hardly the sexiest destination for a major gift, but one that was badly needed. These were both record-level gifts. White gave money to two other Brooklyn mainstays, too, the Brooklyn Museum and the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Up in the Bronx, big gifts went to make improvements to the New York Botanical Garden. To this day, the Leon Levy Foundation remains the largest private donor to New York's outer boroughs. One other philanthropist who made a stir in Brooklyn, but not in a good way, is Joshua Rechnitz, a 40-something hipster heir with a love of bicycle racing. In 2012, Rechnitz offered up what was then the largest gift ever to a New York City park, $40 million to build a velodrome racing track in the new Brooklyn Bridge Park. The offer was quickly accepted by the public-private entity overseeing the new park, only to set off head-scratching and controversy. Most people don't even know what a velodrome is, and understandably so. Racing single-gear bikes without brakes on a banked indoor track ranks among the more esoteric sports. The heyday of velodrome racing was over a century ago, at which time it drew huge crowds to tracks throughout New York and elsewhere. Rechnitz dreamed of throngs of people once more cheering on cyclists racing indoors at speeds of up to 45 miles per hour. He had formed a nonprofit, Velodrome NYC, and had been scouting for locations before focusing on the Brooklyn Bridge Park. His proposed facility would have seating for 2,500 spectators and be housed in a field house that would accommodate other recreational activities. After the novelty of Rechnitz's historic gift wore off, the backlash began. Some wondered why a rich guy with obscure tastes got to dictate how a sizable piece of the new park, as large as a football field, was used. "The number of people who really want it you can count on the fingers of your left hand," wrote one community critic of the racetrack. What is it doing in our park? Why help the city build a huge stadium in a tiny waterfront park for this quaint, obscure, bizarre sport? Other locals worried about the additional traffic the velodrome would bring to the cobblestone streets of Brooklyn Heights, and wondered why Reichnitz's gift had been accepted without more input from the community. As Brooklynites thought about their hopes for the borough's first major new park in decades, a velodrome was pretty much the last priority that came to mind. Private money, not public interest, was shaping a park that was supposed to be for everyone. Reichnitz fought back against the critics with a team that included lawyers and architects. He finally abandoned his plans in 2013, although not because of community opposition, or so he said. The cost of the project had kept rising, and even after Reichnitz pledged an additional $10 million, it wasn't enough. He was wealthy, but he was no Barry Diller. Nor, in his style, was Reichnitz a Shelby White, who had focused her giving on Brooklyn institutions valued by the entire community. White's giving did raise a troubling question, though. Why was her philanthropy needed at all? What kind of great city can't properly maintain an Olmsted jewel like Prospect Park, or meet the basic infrastructure needs for the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, which draws a million visitors a year? In this country, we don't really fund public infrastructure and public spaces as we do in other countries, Emily Lloyd, the head of the Prospect Park Alliance, told the New York Times in 2013. It's always a huge stretch. Lloyd's point wasn't quite right. There once was a time, before the Reagan years, when government did fund infrastructure and other public goods like parks at a higher level. But that era was now past, and the money that was flowing wasn't allocated fairly. When Wall Street was booming, Bloomberg had increased spending on parks, but with an approach that relied on public-private partnerships and bypassed many parks that private players didn't care about. So it is, wrote Michael Kimmelman in the Times, that some city parks have been reduced to the status of beggars. City of Wealthy Angels. In the 1920s, downtown Los Angeles was among the top metropolises in America. It was dubbed the Wall Street of the West, thanks to all the banks and other financial institutions clustered on Spring Street in ornate office buildings, while grand hotels, theaters, movie palaces, and department stores lined other streets. The city's rail lines were more extensive than New York's, with 1,100 miles of track. Within a half century, though, L.A.'s downtown had become a case study in urban decline, doomed by the rise of the automobile and suburbanization. Many of the big businesses were gone, along with the theaters and department stores. The area became best known for having one of the largest concentrations of homeless people in America, on Skid Row. Today, the homeless still camp en masse in Skid Row, but now they share downtown Los Angeles with throngs of hipsters, tourists, and museum-goers. Rebranded DTLA, the area has moved to the forefront of urban gentrification. A key driver of that shift has been the area's transformed cultural institutions. These include the Los Angeles Philharmonic, housed in a spectacular Frank Gehry building sheathed in a stainless steel skin that opened in 2003. The Los Angeles County Museum of Art, which was transformed starting in 2004 with new buildings and collections, and the Museum of Contemporary Art, founded in 1979 and greatly expanded since, which has one of the top collections of modern art in the world. Then there is the latest addition to the downtown cultural scene, another museum of modern art, which opened in the fall of 2015, called The Broad. It holds the collection of Eli and Edith Broad, who paid $140 million to have the museum built. The Broad's art holdings, some 8,000 works, by such artists as Jasper Johns, Jeff Koons, Roy Lichtenstein, and Andy Warhol, has been valued at over $2 billion. Now, anyone can see many of those pieces free of charge. Eli Broad was one of the men who helped doom downtown Los Angeles in earlier times. He made the first chunk of his fortune starting in the 1960s by mass-producing suburban homes as a co-founder of KB Home, which became the largest home builder in the United States. Broad later went on to make an even bigger fortune by transforming an insurance company into a financial powerhouse, Sun America, which he would sell to AIG for $18 billion. He is the only person to have created two Fortune 500 companies. Los Angeles has been the prime locus of Broad's giving, and he's done more than any private citizen to transform downtown, putting up many millions of dollars and generating loads of controversy along the way. Broad grew up in Michigan, the son of Jewish immigrants from Lithuania. His father, who was a socialist, ran a five-and-dime store in Detroit. His mother was a dressmaker. Broad went to Detroit public schools and then to Michigan State University, where he majored in accounting. After he graduated, he became the youngest certified public accountant, CPA, in Michigan history. Broad went into house building to make more money and, with his partner, Donald Kaufman, pushed into a growing market by building cheaper houses. Their big idea was to cut costs by selling houses without basements. "We were always at the lower end of the market," Broad told me. Eventually, Broad and Kaufman moved to the fast-growing West, first to Arizona, and then to Los Angeles. As Broad became wealthy, he wanted to give back in Los Angeles, a city famous for allowing people to invent new paths forward for themselves, including many Jewish newcomers who felt shut out of the power structures of the East. Broad said about L.A., "It's a meritocracy. It's been very good to me business-wise. It's given me an opportunity to do things I couldn't do in other cities because I didn't have the right political background, family background, religious background, and so on." From his earliest days as a philanthropist, Broad was never interested in just writing checks. Instead, he was keen to create things that didn't exist before or to make existing institutions better, as he described it. And one thing that didn't exist in Los Angeles when Broad moved there in the 1960s was any sense of an urban center, or many of the institutions that might anchor such a center. L.A. had no opera or ballet, and little in the way of theater. Its art museums were anemic, with almost no modern art. There wasn't much mystery as to why downtown was empty and desolate. No one had any reason to go there. "This city was 100 suburbs trying to find a city," Broad said, repeating a familiar cliché about the sprawling metropolis. A key date in downtown L.A.'s renaissance is 1979, when the philanthropist Marcia Simon Wiseman started the push to create the Museum of Contemporary Art, MoCA. Wiseman pledged both cash and art from her private collection to create the museum. Eli Broad was among the early donors, putting up $1 million for the MoCA, along with Max Pilevsky, who had made his fortune as an early tech entrepreneur. Broad did more than contribute to MoCA. He led a fundraising campaign that raised $13 million. MoCA would open downtown on Grand Avenue in 1986. Broad was named founding chairman. The following year, Lillian Disney, the widow of Walt Disney, made a $50 million gift to create a concert hall for the Los Angeles Philharmonic, also on Grand Avenue. After construction stalled due to funding problems, Eli Broad stepped forward to lead a new fundraising effort in partnership with Mayor Richard Reardon. The Disney family and the Disney Company would ultimately kick in around $110 million for the project. Broad's own contributions to what became the Walt Disney Concert Hall were around $25 million. Meanwhile, Broad kept giving to the MoCA as it expanded, with his donations ultimately totaling over $15 million. He also exerted huge influence over the museum after it encountered hard times in 2008, and Broad stepped in to bail it out. As well, Broad has been a big player in developing the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, giving nearly $60 million to construct a new building for the museum, which opened in 2008. He is a lifetime trustee of the LACMA. Broad was also instrumental in creating the Grand Arts High School in downtown, which was inspired by similar schools elsewhere, such as New York's LaGuardia High School of Music and Art and Performing Arts, which was immortalized in Fame. The project exemplified Broad's hands-on approach to philanthropy. He helped lead the effort to sell the city's education administrators on the idea of an arts high school, and then, once the school was approved, Broad helped pay for an architectural competition for its new building on Grand Avenue, one that would complement the other new institutions he had helped create. Eli Broad has often drawn criticism for his dominant role in the arts in Los Angeles, with others in that world complaining about his heavy-handed, controlling tactics. Broad, for his part, has complained at times that not enough donors were stepping up to help turn L.A. into a modern metropolis through grand cultural projects. The city, he has said, shouldn't be a one-philanthropist town. There were other arts donors in L.A., of course, a community that has collectively helped mobilize hundreds of millions of dollars over the decades to revitalize the city's cultural scene. But none have had the deep pockets or drive of Broad. One reason for his outsized influence has also been the weakness of public funding for the arts. In 2003, the budget of the California Arts Council was cut more than 90%, and it has never fully recovered. The state now ranks almost last in the nation in public funding for the arts. The lack of government money has meant that private arts funders, like Broad, have had more clout in setting the cultural agenda in California. Another area in Los Angeles where Broad has exerted influence is public education. In August 2015, readers of the Los Angeles Times learned that the Broad Foundation was secretly working on a plan to dramatically expand the scope of charter schools in the city. A month later, more details emerged. The foundation was teaming up with other deep-pocketed education funders, including the Walton Family Foundation, in a push to move over half of all school children in Los Angeles into charter schools. By the time this plan emerged, Eli Broad had already given hundreds of millions of dollars for education reform efforts nationwide. Among his major aims has been to draw talented people into education leadership positions through the Broad Academy, which trains administrators to run urban school systems. The larger goal of Broad's education-related giving has been to break what he calls a tired government monopoly. Like other big donors to charters, such as the Fisher family, which made its billions from the Gap clothing stores, Broad believes the competition posed by charter schools will force traditional public schools to step up their game. Broad came over time to the idea of remaking L.A.'s school system with charters. When he first became involved in education in Los Angeles in the 1990s, he focused on making changes within the existing system by seeking to influence the Los Angeles Unified School District. "But nothing changed. We have very strong teachers' unions here," Broad told me. He added that he had nothing against unions. "I'm from a union family." But he did have a problem with detailed collective bargaining agreements that stipulate what teachers will and will not do and make it very hard to fire teachers. Charters are widely favored by education reformers as a way to get around teachers' unions. "Looking at how we had tried to change things," Broad said, "I came to the conclusion that the only way to make things happen would be to have more school choice, more competition, more charter schools." Over the past decade, the Broad Foundation has helped turn Los Angeles into a center of the charter school movement. Broad has pumped millions into this effort, backing efforts at both the state and the city level to spread charters. His foundation has been one of the biggest donors to the California Charter Schools Association, the top advocacy group pushing for laws more favorable to charter schools, and he's backed other groups that focus on swaying policy in Sacramento. Broad's political donations in California have worked in tandem with his philanthropy. He was a major donor to Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was a fervid champion of charters as governor. Broad also gave heavily to candidates running for state superintendent of public instruction, a pivotal post shaping education policy in the state. As with his arts projects downtown, Broad has pulled multiple levers of power to reshape education in L.A., levers only available to the super-rich. By 2015, L.A. had more kids in charter schools than any other city, with over 200 charters serving over 100,000 students. The new plan, backed by Broad and other funders, called the Great Public Schools Now Initiative, aimed to more than double that number, adding 260 new charter schools over a period of just 8 years. Broad and the other philanthropists hoped to put up $490 million to fund the expansion. It was a breathtaking plan, the most ambitious push ever by charter school advocates. If the effort succeeds, it will create one of the biggest shifts in any urban education system in decades, one largely orchestrated by private money. And while the Broad Foundation won't say what share of the total cost it will shoulder to make this expansion happen, the sum is likely to be in the tens of millions of dollars. A memo outlining the plan, obtained by the Los Angeles Times, said that donors plan to set aside $21.5 million to deal with the political hurdles to creating more charter schools. This money would go, among other things, to fund a legislative strategy to undo regulatory interference with charter schools. It would also be spent to mobilize pro-charter parents in low-income communities, which has been a key strategy of charter backers. Broad and the other funders already had a strong start in this regard. For several years, they had been backing Parent Revolution, an organization that advocated for charter schools in Los Angeles and beyond. The group's name might suggest support from a groundswell of local activists. In fact, just a few philanthropies provided most of its budget. Between 2012 and 2014, the Broad Foundation had given the group nearly $1.5 million. The Laura and John Arnold Foundation gave it even more, $4.5 million. And the Walton Foundation had kicked in big, too. Beyond parents, the Broad Foundation had an eye on the media. It was among several pro-charter funders that gave $800,000 to fund a new education reporting project by the Los Angeles Times, money the beleaguered paper accepted despite the obvious conflict of interest posed by the gift. Finally, Eli Broad and other wealthy donors, including Michael Bloomberg, Doris Fisher, and members of the Walton family, personally made $2.3 million in campaign contributions in 2015 to a pro-charter PAC that aimed to influence the L.A. school board elections. Four seats on the seven-member board, which would have a big say over the fate of the Broad charter plan, were up for grabs. The donations by pro-charter funders, which turned the school board race into the most expensive in the nation, weren't revealed until months after ballots had been cast. This wasn't the first time that mega donors had poured money into a local school board race in the United States. In recent years, pro-charter philanthropists have also sought to influence school board races in New Orleans, Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Denver with campaign gifts. Broad has been among the contributors helping nationalize local school board races, as one study put it. Previously, teachers' unions had been the main donors in such races, usually at small levels. Broad and other donors to education-related elections see themselves as leveling the playing field, although in the 2015 school board races in L.A., they outspent the unions by over $1 million as they sought to set the stage for the biggest expansion of urban charter schools ever. The political hurdles to what was quickly dubbed the Broad Plan soon became evident when the city's top teachers' union came out in opposition. United Teachers Los Angeles, UTLA, President Alex Caputo Pearl said, "We're going to make every effort that we can to organize against the expansion of what are essentially unregulated non-union schools that don't play by the rules as everybody else." Caputo Pearl also told the Times, "We're concerned about anything Eli Broad is involved with." In September 2015, when the Broad Museum opened on Grand Avenue, the teachers' union led a protest. "Invest in public schools, not billionaire vanity projects," said one sign. But it wasn't just the unions who had qualms about the plan. Some observers questioned the rush to expand the city's charter schools when the existing charter schools were achieving what the LA Schools report called mixed results. In January 2016, the LA School Board voted 7-0 for a resolution aimed at checking the Broad Plan. Diane Ravitch captured the sentiments of many critics of education reform philanthropy when she wrote about the LA plan. The really important question is why a billionaire should be allowed to buy half of a public institution. If Eli Broad didn't like policing in Los Angeles, could he buy half the police force? If he thought the public parks were not well run, could he buy half of them? Why should he be allowed to buy half the children in LAUSD? In truth, Broad and the other funders behind his charter plan were thinking well beyond the students in LAUSD. The memo detailing their plan stated, "Los Angeles is uniquely positioned to create the largest, highest-performing charter sector in the nation." Broad told me that the goal is a model that can be emulated in other cities. It's not just about us. As for his critics, Broad doesn't worry much about them. He's famously not concerned with being Mr. Nice, unlike his wife Edith, who has many admirers. "My wife is not as aggressive as I am," Broad said. "I'm respected, and she's loved." Edith has little interest in education philanthropy, which Broad said is not pleasant work. He adds, "She wonders why I spend all this time and energy on something that is frustrating where you can't make rapid progress." Even as he and other unelected private donors work to improve LA's public school system, Broad disputes the idea that there is anything undemocratic about his tactics. Like many philanthropists throwing their weight around in public life in ways that ordinary citizens can't imagine, Broad sees himself as expanding the dialogue, not dominating it. "I think everyone is getting heard. We're getting heard, the philanthropists. The unions and administrators are getting heard. Overall, we're creating debate." Broad, who is in his early 80s, told me he is working harder than ever. So far, he's given away more than $4 billion and plans to give billions more. Not long before he was elected mayor of New York in 2001, Michael Bloomberg ran into his old friend Vartan Gregorian on the street in New York. Gregorian led the Carnegie Corporation, which was among the oldest foundations in America and one with close ties to nonprofits in the city. Gregorian told Bloomberg that these groups were reeling as a result of the attacks of September 11 and an economic downturn. Could Bloomberg do more to help them out, using his vast personal wealth? Bloomberg agreed, and soon sent over a very large check to Carnegie, which the foundation was free to use as it saw fit. More big checks followed after Bloomberg took office, arriving each December, with the sums rising into the tens of millions of dollars. Carnegie spread the money far and wide to hundreds of nonprofits around the city, particularly arts and cultural groups. Ultimately, by 2010, more than $200 million would flow from Bloomberg through his program. And while the grants were made by Carnegie and Bloomberg stayed anonymous, it was widely known that the mayor had quietly become one of the largest private funders of nonprofits in the city. An inspiring story of generosity? Certainly, as the money proved a crucial lifeline for many groups during tough times. But this giving was also deeply unsettling, particularly to Bloomberg's political rivals, who didn't have anything like his resources with which to buy influence around the city. The New York Times reported that when Bloomberg was pushing the city council to revise the city's term limits law to allow him to run for a third term as mayor, his aides asked several groups that had received Carnegie grants to lobby for the change publicly. Others, presumably, didn't have to be asked. They knew who their sugar daddy was. The change to the law was ultimately approved, allowing Bloomberg to run for a third term in 2009. It would be his toughest race yet, but Bloomberg eked out a narrow victory over Democratic challenger William C. Thompson. He spent $103 million on his final race for office, or about $183 per vote. The following year, Bloomberg pulled the plug on the Carnegie Grants program for city nonprofits. Chapter 5. Disruptors. Sean Parker grew up in suburban Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C. He learned to code at a young age after his father, who had been chief scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, taught him how to program on an Atari 800. His fascination with computers led the FBI to his door when he was a teenager, after he hacked into a Fortune 500 company. As a minor, he was let off with community service. Parker won the Virginia State Science Fair after creating a web crawler and did so well financially in high school, working for D.C. area tech companies, that he decided to skip college. Parker became a hero in the hacker world after 1999, when he and Sean Fanning created Napster, a music file sharing service. Napster was widely popular with music lovers, attracting tens of millions of users and fundamentally disrupting the recording industry. It was equally unpopular with music creators and was eventually shut down by lawsuits. Parker's next project, the networking site Plaxo, also did well, but he was ousted after differences with the venture capitalist who controlled the company. Then, in 2004, Parker hooked up with Mark Zuckerberg and became the first president of Facebook. Parker saw the transformative potential of the business, even as Zuckerberg himself still hedged his bets, working on a side project called WireHog. Sean was pivotal in helping Facebook transform from a college project into a real company, Zuckerberg later told Forbes. Parker recruited Peter Thiel as the company's first investor and, during subsequent investment rounds, helped structure Facebook so that Zuckerberg had complete control of its board. Parker had learned the hard way what can happen when venture capitalists hold power over young entrepreneurs. As it turned out, though, Parker would be ousted from Facebook by the company's financiers after he was arrested in 2005 on a cocaine charge that was later dropped. Parker walked away from his short involvement at Facebook with enough stock to later become a billionaire while still in his early 30s. He bought multiple homes in California, as well as a $20 million townhouse in Greenwich Village, and traveled on private jets. He filled closets with expensive suits and eyeglasses and shoes. His 2013 wedding, amid the redwoods in Big Sur, with guests wearing costumes created by the Lord of the Rings costume designer, reportedly cost millions of dollars to orchestrate. Yet even if Parker had gone on spending at this rate through his lifetime, he would only have scratched the surface of a fortune estimated at $2.4 billion in 2016. Besides, Parker saw big problems that he wanted to help solve, starting in the area of health. He had struggled all his life with food allergies, which can produce terrifying and life-threatening anaphylactic allergic reactions. Parker was interested in other health threats, too, like cancer. And he was fascinated by the failure of medicine to conquer such challenges. He said about food allergies at one point, "This should be a curable disease, but all we've done is put band-aids on it. We've been treating symptoms for 100 years. Parker believed that one key to making big medical breakthroughs, not just on allergies and cancer, but on many other problems, such as diabetes and arthritis, lay in the autoimmune system. Any number of diseases come about because the immune system goes sideways and attacks the body's tissues rather than doing its proper job, which is to keep us healthy. A huge amount of costs in the healthcare system goes toward treating these diseases that have, at their root, an immunological component that needs to be addressed," Parker said. And yet, there was reason to believe that this is what Parker would call a hackable problem, drawing on new research on immune mechanisms. In 2015, after a flurry of big gifts for autoimmune research, Parker stepped things up further, announcing that he was setting aside $600 million to create the Parker Foundation, with a big focus on the life sciences. The goal was to orchestrate new breakthroughs that would accelerate novel immunotherapies and treatment strategies. In April 2016, Parker got more focused, committing $250 million to launch the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy.